Well, hello and welcome to the Daily Objective, a special weekend edition of the Daily Objective, and in fact, a very special one. We are privileged to have an Azerbaijani who's lived in Russia, who's now living in the Netherlands, come from Russia. He has insights that probably, we speak so glibly here about Russia, and we don't hear from anyone who's actually from Russia, who's lived in Russia, but we're privileged today to have now. Please correct me if I get your name wrong. Emil Yosifov, who happens to be an Azerbaijani who's lived in Russia, who can give us some insight, and particularly in the wake of all the news that's been coming out of Russia. There was that terrible ISIS attack in Russia recently, and it brings to mind, of course, the dynamic between what's going on in the Middle East and what's going on in Russia in a very complex way. But more than that, Russia and its war currently with Ukraine, we've been talking a lot about. And more than that, of course, as the Ayn Rand Center UK, we talk a great deal about cultural issues, dictatorship, and of course, Ayn Rand herself was from Russia. And so very frequently we will discuss Russian art, Russian literature, Russian themes. And who better but Emil to give us some insight into that? So could you tell us a little bit, though, about your background, Emil?
Yes. So I'm originally from Azerbaijan. I grew up in Russia. I've spent there basically the first 20 years of my life. I used to study international relations at what was considered to be one of the best universities in Russia. And then I moved to the Netherlands, and I've been living here in the Netherlands for 5 years already.
One of the things about Putin is, people are aware that he's an autocrat. People are aware that he kills his enemies both inside and outside of the country when necessary. And when people think of Russia, we think of a history of autocracy that is relentless. There was a moment when the Soviets fell apart. Boris Yeltsin came in. There was some thought that perhaps freedom, Western ideas would finally penetrate, and we could maybe get a non-autocratic, non-authoritarian government in Russia. But of course, we didn't. We ended up with an autocrat like Putin. How do you explain that? How do you understand something like that?
There are several factors that led to the establishment of Putin as an autocratic and then now gradually becoming a totalitarian leader, basically. First of all, you have to understand that based on the history, based on the Russian history, Russia has never had any kind of private property, any kind of the idea of human rights. The Enlightenment basically passed most of the Russian population by. It did not touch the 90% of the population that used to be poor artisans, without property, without land, without anything. And even when the basically slavery was canceled in Russia, and the people were freed in 1861, they did not receive any kind of land. They did not receive any kind of property. Nothing changed for them, and that continued to be so more or less. There were exceptions in the beginning of the 20th century, but that continued to be so. And there was no private property. There was no economic interest that the majority of the population of Russia could pursue aside or apart from, just making enough for their own subsistence and for the subsistence of their families. So, of course, there was hatred among the artisans, among the peasants. There was the hatred towards the government. There was the hatred towards, towards the rich, and that all led to the kind of to the fact that most of the opposition leaders were socialists. There were various parties, but they all were socialist. We know what it led to. And the existence of the Soviet Union was the only basically alternative when the only thing that you have is basically 140 million of slaves, you know, in your country.
In effect, what you're saying is that whether it was Soviet communism, you know, or it is the more traditional orthodox authoritarianism that we're seeing from Vladimir Putin, it is essentially, both are in effect expressions of Russian culture and the ideas. I mean, we think of obviously authoritarianism being an authoritarian monarchy, an imperial monarchy, resisting Mongol invasions, resisting Turkish threats through the Black Sea, forcing Russia into a very authoritarian, warlike stance for a long time. We know of Peter the Great trying to westernize. Didn't he come to where you live now, Netherlands, another place, England, come back with all these Western ideas, build St. Petersburg, but they never really sank, is what you're saying. And indeed,
yes.
A kind of slavery persisted well into the 19th century. And even as it's being formally, allegedly being formally done away with, in effect, it's persisting in practice, because what you have is a rural agrarian population without property, without any sense of individual property rights at all. And so whether it's the old religious czarist total regime, the communist total regime, or now Putin, who's a totalitarian in his inclinations, but more traditional Eastern Orthodox in his religious and philosophical approach, it doesn't really matter. These are all natural expressions of the Russian psychology and culture.
Yes, in a sense it is. And you correctly mentioned an example of Peter the Great, who came to the Netherlands and tried to, you know, he actually revolutionized the Russian alphabet. He tried to introduce, I mean, many words were introduced from the West, and that was indeed the case at the when the Soviet Union fell. Russians had a, you know, they saw capitalism coming in. They saw, you know, all these goods, services, you know, private business spreading around. They saw the variety that they had never seen before. But the fact is, if you do not have conceptual ground, if you do not have a theoretical basis and a theoretical understanding of why these concretes are significant, then you will lose it and you will not defend. You will not defend them. And that is what happened to the Russian, to the modern Russians who nowadays live there. All these people had seen the freedom flowing in, you know, the private property, the inception of private businesses. And yet, why are they not fighting for that?
Well, surely the Russians have even recently seen how improved things have gotten in Lithuania and Poland and Hungary since the Soviet influence has been lifted, or do they see that? And does it not inspire them to move more in a direction of private property and trade with the West?
They see it all, and they even might recognize all of this, but they disregard it because their theoretical basis, again, the problem with the Russian culture is that the people there, and that is what I have also noticed by on my own experience, just interacting with the locals there for years. The people, everyone, or the majority of people, have their point of view. They have their view of what truth is, and they are ready to persuade you. They will convince you. They will fight
you. In the West,
you.
We have a lot of skepticism and uncertainty and relativism.
Yes.
And that makes us hesitate and qualify. But, and you know, most Russians of my acquaintance are highly educated people. But what you're saying is that they have a kind of epistemological or philosophical confidence in their position. And they have philosophies.
They have philosophies. And these people are very well educated. Don't underestimate them. They are the Russians, even those who do not have higher education, are very well educated because their school, the primary education, the secondary education is very high quality. And they are much better educated than the Europeans in this sense. But the problem is that these people are rationalists. In a sense that they might create theories, they might even come up with the theories, but the theories never correspond to reality, and they do not use reality as the basis for their theories. That makes a huge difference, because whatever examples they might see, whatever concrete they might see, however much freedom they might see in other countries, and the internet is open. And they can all read and see. It's not even needed for the Russian government to close up the internet, because they know that these people will not change their minds by just by seeing the examples out there.
But seeing that people like Germany or Japan or Great Britain live such better material lives than, aren't they enthused about life? Don't they become, or is this negative, malevolent sort of sense of life sort of rooted in Russian culture?
Yes, and that, and here we are coming to the second important factor here. And that is, whenever you ask a Russian person, you know, okay, tell me about your life, and you expect that he will tell you about his journey, what he was doing, and you know, what, how he got into his profession, whatever. And mostly the first thing that you hear is, yeah, my life was very hard. I suffered a lot. And this cult of suffering that you observe among these people is very profound. Because if you think about it philosophically, it means a certain kind of fatalism. And that comes from the Orthodox Christianity, from the morality that is motivated by Orthodox Christianity. You might see atheists among these people, but the morality is still there. You might see people who romanticize certain ideals for themselves, who want to achieve something, but deeply inside, they think that they are convinced that, you know, results are, success is quite random. You cannot seriously expect happiness. What you have to do is overcome suffering, overcome hardships. And for that, you have to get high quality education, you have to get good job, you have to start business, and some of them actually, you know, proceed to becoming really successful people. But that all is done based on this malevolent universe premise, based on the on a certain kind of, on a fight against a certain kind of threat, on this on a permanent struggle that never ends. And obviously, you know, when you do not expect much of life, when you do not expect happiness, when you do not expect that, you know, everything that is achieved by such countries as the United States, the European countries, Japan, Korea, is actually predictably achievable, then you disregard these examples, because you consider them as random, you know. And then, but it is also the fact that you start feeling hatred towards them, because still, you know, your human nature cannot be changed. You feel unhappy in such a state. And it is then when it is this that gives the Russians a certain kind of nationalism, which is not the love for their country, which is not patriotism, but it is the hatred for everything and everyone who
everything
has
else.
Exactly.
May I quote a letter that Ayn Rand, when Ayn Rand came to the United States in her 20s, this is almost 98 years ago now. She comes to the United States from living in Russia. She writes to her Russian family. She says, in America, it's one of the things that surprised her most, and she wanted to report to her family. In America, everything is laughs and jokes. Everyone is constantly smiling and joking. And I just found that to be very interesting, that her initial emotional impression is, rather than you You begin a conversation with a Russian, they begin to tell you about their sufferings and their complaints. Ayn Rand's first impression when she comes to America as a Russian is, wow, all they're doing is laughing and joking and smiling around here. It's a totally different sense of life. In other words, the belief that success is possible, that with through effort, individuals can achieve. And so what you're saying is this becomes as in Russia, but sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you need political friends to pull strings for you to get any success in this world, it's all part of this fatalistic determinism, which is a self-fulfilling sort of psychological prophecy.
And just to show how it led to to what Putin has now become, if you consider life as just permanent suffering, never-ending suffering, then you cannot expect that you might change something, that you might make a difference, because again, results are not possible, values are not possible to be achieved. And it is then that you succumb to any kind of authority that claims that it has some kind of truth, it has discovered a way for the country, or you know that it will show how to live. That
So
is
it's still a
the problem.
symbolic accident that the Kremlin goes from the Russian Orthodox Church to the Communist Party, and now it's sort of a nationalist sort of monument to their collectivist authoritarianism over the centuries. It's very it's, so it doesn't matter what you're saying is that it's what Marxism and Christian Orthodoxy share that's more important.
Whether
They're
you take, yes, whether you take the Tsarist Russia, the empire that is, or whether you take the Soviet Union or the Putin Russia, one thing is in common. The cult of death, not the cult of death, but the cult of suffering. They don't want you to die, they want you to suffer. And they want each other, everyone else to suffer in their
Wow.
society. And the cult of suffering is what lies in common among these regimes, and that is what does not let Russia to become let Russia become a prosperous society, because with the kind of education that these people have, with the kind of knowledge that these people have, this could have become a wonderful, prosperous, free country with a lot of capitalism, with all this variety of products and services, not imported from the United States, but created by the Russians. And yet it does not happen. And it does not happen precisely because both on the personal level and on the political level, you do not expect values, you do not ex expect to achieve values. You do not expect predictably to keep achieving your results and, expect happiness.
So when Putin invades Ukraine, fails to take Kiev, when there's enormous casualty, Russian casualties, this is sort of the Russian expectation. Suffering is built in.
This is
If we can't take Kiev, if we lose a bunch of soldiers, this is life. We should sort of expect this. This is not going to change in any way, though, our hatred for everything non-Russian and our desire to reestablish the Russian Empire. Now I know it's kind of at a stalemate now, but in the initial phases of the invasion, it was costing Russia enormous treasure and lives, and yet the Russians didn't push back on, didn't overthrow Putin and say, "Ah, your failure to take Kiev means you should be l thrown from power."
But this is what the Western society probably does not understand about the Russians. These people will win, not because they are so smart, or not because they are stronger than Ukrainians, but because they do not care about their casualties. They do not care about whatever suffering you might impose on them. All these sanctions do not matter because these people are used to living in poverty. And the whole life, their whole concept of life is about overcoming poverty. But there is not, or overcoming some kind of threat that they might create in their head. But the point is, there is no positive goal in mind. Just as with the Ukraine, think about what Russia wants to achieve, you know, if it actually takes over the whole of Ukraine. What does it want to achieve? Does it want to achieve prosperity? No. It is pure destruction for the sake of destruction. But the fact is that many people, and I'm not saying all of them, because there are wonderful, smart, brilliant people whom I deeply respect myself. There are wonderful friends of mine that live there and who also escaped Russia somehow.
One of my best friends lives in St. Petersburg with his family.
Yes, but many people do not have any positive goal in their lives. You know, anything that they want to strive for, that they want to develop, you know, themselves for, they want primarily to develop them, to improve their situation against a certain threat that exists, and not pro some particular positive value, and that is the difference.
I can see many big differences, but recently on Ayn Rand Center UK programs, we've been discussing the Israel-Hamas conflict that's going on right now in great detail. And what we've pointed to many times is that the fault is not with the human beings there, of course. It's the culture. It's the culture that dominates the Palestinians that is behind the problem. It's a religiously rooted one. It's one that's happy to martyr itself. Now, I know there's big differences, as I say, as I introduced this with, but in effect, again, we find that the answer to, say, Putin's aggression, and the reason why the Russians don't push him out, is precisely that. It's Russian culture that keeps it mired in authoritarian forms of government. It's their religiously based fatalism, for example, that has them anti the rest of the world in a kind of odd kind of nationalism, and expecting enormous casualties, in effect, from at least not pushing out Putin as a result from the invasion of Ukraine. Again, it's philosophy, it's culture that's the answer.
Yes, and I think one important point that I would like to make is that the contrast that I began to see when I came here to the Netherlands is that in Russia, everyone had their concept of truth, and they always were trying to, you know, impose that truth on you, or to convince you, or to persuade you that this is the way. In Russia, people are ready to fight for what they think is right. And they are willing to find truth. The only weakness that they have is that this truth or this theory that they might create themselves, whatever it might be, is never based on reality, because they do not recognize reality as a source of truth. You know. By contrast, in Europe at least, people are not ready to fight for themselves. They do not have any particular theory or principle that they uphold, and they are ready to stand up for. So it is for this reason that Russia will win again, if it ever fights against
the West. They have a natural advantage because they're consistent. They believe.
Because they know, exactly. Because they are consistent in their irrational theories.
Right.
And they are ready to fight for it, the casualties notwithstanding.
That's a tremendous advantage. It certainly is.
It is. And it is, I think it is very similar to what Hamas and the Islamic totalitarian regimes are doing. They do
and
not
so
care.
Again, to sort of answer the thing, there are innocent Russians, just as there are innocent Muslim Arabs. The question is, what is the dominant culture? What is the culture that's dominating? Daniel, do we have any super chats?
We have a super chat from Bonnie. Thank you so much. A super sticker from Jonathan Honig. Thank you so much. And another super sticker from Jonathan. Thank you so much. No questions.
Okay, and how are we doing on time, Daniel?
We have a couple of minutes.
Well, I just want to thank you, Emil, for joining us today. It's really been a your debut on Ayn Rand Center UK has been a smashing success. Thank you for giving us insight. Is that how can people, if they want to talk to you more, how can they get in touch with you? Are you on social media?
Oh yes, they can find me on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram. You can just type Emil Yusifov
Very
and
good.
you will find me.
And I'm sure Dan will be kind enough to put those in the comments and the links here below.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, thank you, Emil, for joining us. And everyone, we'll see you tomorrow for another episode of The Daily Objective.